Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Patty, from outside of Philadelphia. I'm sorry, I forgot the town name.
Man Young.
Dim the lights and all. My name's Patty, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is May 10th, 2004. I have a home group, which is the Man Young Big Book, in Man Young, Pennsylvania, and Philadelphia. And I have a sponsor, and I do sponsor other women. So, a little nervous, just slightly. But there's a clock there, too. That's good. All right, I'm driving out here tonight, and I'm thinking, okay, God, all right, so it's just you and me. That's what I always say before I share, like, okay, God, it's you and me. And my first sponsor told me that she would always say, put the words in my mouth, love in my heart, and let me speak the truth, you know. And so that's what I'm here to share with you all tonight. So, you know, I don't know. This microphone is really hitting my face. But I was thinking about from the beginning, you know. And as a small child, I grew up in New Jersey and then moved up to Rhode Island when my parents got divorced. But as a very young child, from a very, very early age, I can always remember not feeling right. Like that, oh, thanks. That, oh, perfect. Yay. But I never felt right, you know. I remember asking my mom. I have one other sister who's 6 years older than me, and I remember asking my mom when I was very young if I was adopted, because I didn't look like my family. My dad was like short and pudgy and had real dark hair, and my mom had whatever color came out of the Clairol box. And my sister had brown hair, and I had, like, really platinum blonde hair and these freckles, very fair skin. So I asked her, and my mom got really offended by that. You know, I don't really remember what her answer was, but I just remember feeling like, oh, I shouldn't have asked that question. But that's the feeling that I always had as a kid, you know. And I wasn't like them. I was a very, like, very sensitive, like, emotional child. I remember, for some of you older people like me in here, what, like, that Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. I'd watch that show, right, and I'd be screaming because they'd be, like, just tagging the animals, and I'd be screaming like they're killing them, you know, and they're just tagging them. And there was no reasoning with me, and so I was very, very emotional all the time. And I was daddy's little girl. And that really plays into my story, because my sister, being 6 years older than me, she was very defiant. And I was not. I was like, you want me to go over there and sit there? You want me to do that? Okay, yes, just whatever. Just trying to be the good girl. And my sister was not like that at all. And she was abused by my dad. He was just very nasty and mean to her a lot of times, and I remember images of she wouldn't want to eat her spinach or take a vitamin, and he would jack her up by her throat and try to jam the pill down her throat and things like that. And I never got touched. You know, I remember one time my mom told me my dad to take me in the back room and thank me for something I had done, and he took me in the back room and said, all right, so this is what I want you to do. I want you to pretend like I smacked you and come out and, like, look really sad. So I was like, okay, that sounds good. You know? Me and my butt really like that, you know. So and that planted the seed that if as long as I play the part, I can get away with it. You know what I mean? And I wanted to be the center of attention but under the radar at the same time. Because nobody suspects the tow-haired blonde girl with freckles. Nobody suspects her, you know. It's always going to be my sister that's always the troublemaker. So, you know, so that is what I refer to as, like, my big bag of masks. Like, at a very young age, at that 6 or 7 years old, is when I started to put different shapes, different faces into my bag. so that if I needed to fit in a certain place, I'd just rummage around in my bag and I'd find whatever fit, whatever matched you. Whatever you wanted me to be, that's it. I'll find it in the bag, you know. You know, I had my first drink when I was in sixth grade. We went over to my friend's cool aunt's house, right? So we went over there, and they were like, other substance users. And we started to play this game of Uno, and it quickly became a drinking game. And my parents never drank. We never had alcohol in the house. I never saw either one of my parents take a drink. Grandparents. I have one grandfather who I suspect was an alcoholic, but nobody's telling the story. So I'm the token drunk in my family. And we went over there and it became this drinking game. And right off the bat, I discovered that I like to lose. Because the draw four and the reverse and I'm hiding cards, like, oh, I don't have that color. Oh, you got a drink? Okay, you know. And that was fun. That was my first experience. And it was like a dream. It was like, I'm funnier, you're funnier, everything's great, the day is sunnier, everything was great, you know. And so we ride our bikes back to the house. And my other two friends, they're a little tipsy, but I'm instantly out of control. I'm running around the backyard with the phone, with the cord hanging, and I'm running around the backyard talking to whatever, you know, and then I barf in the bushes. So, but I'm instantly that person out of control, and I loved it. But, again, since my family didn't drink, and I didn't really have a lot of access to alcohol, but whenever I did, would go over to a friend's house or whatever, I instantly wanted oblivion. Normally you don't feel your teeth, but that's how I judged how drunk I was. If I can't feel my teeth, okay, then that's sufficient enough, you know. And my friends would always say to me, like, why, what's going on here, you know, with hitting it so hard, you know. Sporadic exposure to alcohol, but every time I always wanted oblivion, always wanted it, and I usually achieved it. So, and then in high school, I was like a band geek, and I did the color guard where you twirl the flags and stuff like that. I hung out with like the geeks, because like the dirt bags is what we called them in high school, were the ones that smoked and hung out in the courtyard, and they were like the cool kids, and I didn't fit in with them. I didn't have a mask in my bag to fit in with them. Through high school, the same experience. It's not really that, my drinking career isn't that glamorous, you know, and like would go to like band camp and things like that and get and drink and things like that. And anytime anybody put a drink down, it was like mysteriously gone, you know, and I'd be hiding it somewhere, you know. But, you know, where I first, you know, thinking back in my story, where I first really developed my keen alcoholic mind was when I was in high school and I had overslept because I had drank too much at my boyfriend's house. So it's 2:00 in the morning, and my mom's bedroom was right at the top of the steps, and it was like, and she'd be up, you know. So I'm thinking, how am I going to get a story to get into the house? Right, so I'm driving home, and I see a dead cat on the side of the road. And I say, that's it. So I stop the car, and this cat is not just, like, freshly dead. It's, like, dead. Okay. So I peel this cat off the grass, and a cop pulls up. So I'm like, oh, my God. Great. And I'm now in Rhode Island, this little bodunk town right outside of Newport. And here comes the cops. So I'm like, oh, great. So he's like, can I help you? And I'm like, this is my cat. So he helps me. So now, again, I'm like, oh, tears? All right, let me rifle around in there. Helpless girl, 2:00 in the morning? That's me. So he gets a box and a bag, and he helps me put it in my car. And so I drive back home, and I put the dead, rigor mortis dead cat out on the front porch. And I come in the house, and my mom says, "What? Like, oh, my God, what happened?" So I ran over this cat. So I think it's dead. So my mom goes out. She's like, "It's dead, honey." I'm like, "Okay, go to bed." I'm like, "All right." Next morning, my sister walks out, and she's like screams at the top of her lungs because there's this dead cat on the porch, right? So one of the many reasons why my sister doesn't really like me today. But you know, that's where I take my mind back to, because normal people, even drinking or not, normal people don't think, let me peel a rigor mortis dead cat off the street and use it to their benefit. You know what I mean? So automatically it reminds me, my mind is abnormal right off the bat. So I start to go through high school, and I graduate high school, and I go to college. And I really didn't know what I wanted to do in college, and so I ended up in nursing school. And because I wanted to be a vet, but it was too much school and whatever. So I figure I'll go to nursing school. And another thing that comes to mind is I lived at home. My school was about 30 minutes away, but I lived at home because somewhere I knew I couldn't do this thing on my own. I couldn't go and live in a dorm or whatever. I just couldn't do it. And so I commuted back and forth to school. And a couple of college parties, really not that much. I don't know. When it came to, like, student, being a student and studying, like, that's, I liked it. So not too many times. But, again, every time I was exposed to alcohol, that was it, you know. And at the time, I had still been dating the guy that, you know, the dead cat sleepover guy, right? So, and he and I really had known each other for a long time. My family started to move out of Rhode Island. They moved away. So I graduated college. And again, that feeling of, I can't stay in Rhode Island because I'm not going to be able to do this on my own. I don't know what. I can't really put words to it sometimes, but I figure I can't do this. So I started to move down. And I ended up in Central Jersey, living with my sister, and I got a job at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And meanwhile, the guy and I had broken up, right? So we get into this conversation. So now I'm like at the age where, okay, the blueprint of my life says you're supposed to be getting married, you're supposed to have kids, like you got this all planned out. So it was either we break up or we get married, right? So, again, my alcoholic will, like, you're going to break up with me or we're going to get married. So let's get married. So we got married, and what's funny is his name was Tim. It'll be funny to you later in the story. it was a laugh riot for me. But he was an alcoholic, and I didn't know it. Really. And so he moved down to Pennsylvania. And meanwhile, my job is going great. And I'm meeting people at work. But he's an alcoholic, and I had this idea that he's just going to get better because I'm going to love him well. I'm going to shower him. I'm going to show him what a good woman I am and what a good wife. And he's just not going to want to drink anymore because I'm going to be so good. And, well, so that didn't work too well. So he told me he drank because he was bored. So my keen alcoholic, let's buy a house. So we buy a house, and 9 months later, we're getting divorced. Because he would try, and then I would try, and then he would give up, and I would give up, and it just didn't work. So, and that's when my life really turned. You know, you have those moments where you can just see where you just turn the corner. And that was it for me because it wasn't in my plan. I told myself, I'm not getting divorced. This is the way it's going to be. And we ended up getting divorced. So I felt like a complete failure. Complete failure. And my family was okay with it. They were all right. But I was not. And that just confirmed to me, I can't do this life thing. My self-esteem was in the gutter. I am a total failure. Meanwhile, at work, I'm like rocking. I'm like doing great stuff at work, right? So it's that two lives that I feel like I'm living already, you know. And so I actually started my first experience with a spiritual malady. Actually, really wasn't too much with drinking. I decided somewhere that I would train to have an eating disorder. So I trained. Yes, I trained. I researched on how to be the best anorexic I could possibly be, and I achieved it. You know, and that just further deepened me right into myself. It was so dark where I was that there was no other way for me to get out of me. And when my eating disorder stopped working, that's when my alcoholism picked up. And it's really funny because I look back on the places where I've lived. I went from Bensalem and Trevose area, where I had the house, to I moved to 15th and Wallace in, like, Spring Garden section of Philly, which is not the nice, like, Fairmount section. It's, like, shoot-em-up kind of section. And that's why I moved out, because I heard gunshots one night and I got afraid. But that's when my alcoholism started to take off. I was hanging around with people at work. And we were going out on Thursday nights and drinking. And these were these big, strapping Irish girls. Sorry. But, and they stood around and drank. Like normal people, I guess. I don't know what it's like to be a normal drinker. It never happened to me. So, but they're standing for hours with one beer. I don't get that. I don't get it. I'm like, what are you doing? Like, so frustrating. Even today, sometimes I'm like, are you going to finish that? Because, really. Like, terrible. You shouldn't be treating alcohol that way. It's terrible. And what started to happen was, as my exposure to alcohol was becoming more frequent, because we would go out and go to bars and things like that, and beach houses and ski houses and things like that, my exposure, and so my progression is starting, and I don't even realize it. And then I started to become that lone wolf. I was that lone wolf because then people stopped inviting me places because I was too much of a liability. If I was supposed to be the designated driver that night, forget it. People didn't want me around. I was always the one flying off the handle, going off with this guy, going over here, doing whatever. I was completely unreliable. And at the time, I didn't smoke. So when my friends saw me light up a cigarette or ask for a cigarette, they were like, oh, brother, not good. Because I would do that because I couldn't physically drink anymore, so I needed a break. And as this progression is starting, I moved from Spring Garden to Germantown. And that is like the quintessential moment where I realized the depths of my alcoholism, because I was so comfortable there. And this isn't a racial statement at all, but no girl that looks like me should be that comfortable in that neighborhood with bars in the window that gave it ambiance. Okay? It was a dark, dark, dark place. And so my alcoholism was ramping up. And my behavior starts to ramp up because now I'm by myself. I can't trust myself to go out because then I start to become violent. You're looking at me, what? And, you know, and the earrings come off, and I bought like dollar store jewelry because I always knew I would be pulling it off by the end of the night. You know, and the vodka muscles would come out because I'm still built. I knew I couldn't trust myself to go out, so I just closed myself in my little cave. And again, meanwhile at work, I'm excelling. I'm promoting. I'm getting promoted. I'm now supervising other people, and I'm doing great at work. But every night at 7 o'clock, that was my time, because normal people, only alcoholics drink during the day. Alcoholics don't work. Alcoholics have a slipper and a shoe. You know, the word alcoholic never entered my mind. I just thought, someday, when I meet the right guy, when I have the right car, when I have the white picket fence, when I get the dog, when I have the kid, that's my magic formula, and that's what's going to fix me. But on the other side, on the back of my mind, I just thought, this is the way my life's going to be. This is the way it's just going to be. So every night I'd come home, and I'd just drink to oblivion every single night, drink to blackout for years and years and years. My progression just started, you know, because I was a fiscally minded drunk. So I started with the box wine, you know. Then that wasn't enough. So then I ramped up to one of my favorite drinks, you know. And I'd start to hide it from myself. But I'd wait until 7 o'clock. 7 o'clock. It's strange what happened. I did move out of Germantown, finally. I found a nice little place in Roxborough, which is like a town right over from where I am. And then I met another guy on the internet, right? It's when AOL had their chat room, so you could be whoever you wanted to be. I didn't need a mask then, because it was all good. And my name was Stacy then. And it was instant love. I meet this guy on the internet from Reno, Nevada, and 6 weeks later, he moves out to Pennsylvania. And we're love. This is love, love. The thing that I should have tipped me off is because he wasn't an alcoholic, and he was one of those, like, annoying happy drunks. Like, he'd drink, and then he'd get, like, happy and silly. And I just wanted to kill him. So he got in the way. He stood right in the middle between me and my alcoholism, because now I couldn't drink anymore the way that I wanted to drink. So now I'm hiding it. Now I'm putting it in the hamper. I love the hamper. Great spot to put it. Oh, my God. Terrific. And over here, and he got right in the middle, and he just kept enabling me and enabling me and enabling me. And out of love, he was going to love me well this time. Needless to say, that didn't work. What happened was, I started to get very, very violent with him. And he was a little bit taller than me and weighed about 260 pounds. And I would attack him, to the point where I would say, how did you get those bruises on your neck? Like the next day, like no clue on how this happened. And he just kept loving me. He just kept loving me. He's passed away since then. But I'm blessed that he was in my life. I'm blessed that he got in the way of my alcoholism just enough to tip me over the edge, even though things got really terrible. I never got arrested or anything like that, but I did a lot of drunk driving, a lot. Driving on, like, Delaware Avenue and wondering why the road is so bumpy and I'm on the train tracks. He saved me many times from getting arrested because I would act out. I'd yell at neighbors. And I just started to do really terrible things. I wouldn't like you because you were nice. And my neighbor upstairs, like, she was very, very nice to me. And I just, one day, just keyed a brand new car, keyed it all the way down the side. Just because she's nice, and I'm not. And she is the person that I knew I would never be. Never. You know, so again, still, alcoholism really isn't entering my mind until the boyfriend hands me a book that says, How to Stop Drinking Without Going to AA. So I get this book, and I said, I'm not going to AA. And he's like, that's what it says. So I rip it in half, and I throw it across the room. And I'm still working at this point. One day I do decide I'm going to pick up this book, see what it's all about. And it starts talking about getting in touch with your feelings and taking bubble baths and taking walks and yoga and deep breathing and all this crap. You know, because I don't know how to do that. If I knew how to do that in the beginning, I wouldn't be standing here now. If I knew how to live life successfully, I wouldn't have to drink the way that I do. And if you had my life that was so terrible, so terrible. If you felt the way that I did in my skin every day, you would have to drink like me too. Because every day my skin was too loose, it was too tight, it didn't fit, something was off, and I knew it at this point. And so what happened was, I go to work one day, and there's all this commotion going on at work. And this other woman who I worked with, I didn't like her because she was nice. She never did anything. I had a huge resentment. Hated this woman. And she kept getting promoted, like, at the same time that I was. And then we get this office, and my boss sticks her right next to me, right? So now I'm like, can't get away from this woman. And I just don't like you because you're nice. One of these people that's, like, talks about God and how everything is a blessing. And that's what I say to that. So I called her out of the goodness. My motive was good. I had a great motive because I wanted to let her know that something was going on behind her back at work. And I leave a message on her answering machine. She calls me after 7 o'clock. Uh-oh. Hamper time. Right? So, there we go. Now you got it. Okay. But all I remember is seeing in the caller ID that it was her, and that was it. So I walk into work the next day, and I say, sorry, Anne-Marie, I didn't get to get your phone call last night. Later that day, my boss calls me in, and she says, Anne-Marie did talk to you last night. She said you were completely incoherent, so what's going on? You don't understand. So I blame it on the boyfriend, right? You don't understand. So much pressure, blah, blah, blah. So she says, okay, all right. So she gives me a pass, like a free pass that time. A month later, I'm fired because I got caught in a lie. My grandmother died for the 17th time. I'm taking a Spanish class at work, which you had to sign up for in order to get the certificate. I was supposed to be in Florida, but yet on Tuesday, I didn't get back from Florida until Thursday, but I'm in class on Tuesday. She calls me into the office. She says, that's it. Now I'm sitting there. The only thing I had left, the only thing that I knew I was good at was being a nurse. That's the only thing. And that's taken away from me now. So I go home that day. And I, for no reason in particular, I tell myself I'm not going to drink. And I didn't, somehow. But the next day, 7 p.m. rolls around. And some friends of mine are calling me to find out, like, what's happening. But they had an idea, like, something was just not right here. So they were a little afraid at that point. And I only met one sober person my whole entire life, and his name was Damien, and he was a nurse. He was a male nurse. I can't stand male nurses. They have too much ego. I don't know. So if you're a male nurse, come up to me and prove me wrong after the meeting. But he was so egotistical, and we had gone out one time, and I said to him, why aren't you drinking? And he's like, I'm an alcoholic. I don't drink. So this is where I know that God, that this higher power is working in my life. I know it without a shadow of a doubt because that's the only name that came to mind. I didn't have his number, but I called somebody else, and I said, I need Damien. So he calls me up, and the next night was a Friday night, and it was after 7. He calls me up, and he says, I'll get ready. Where do you live? Because I'm coming to pick you up for a meeting. So I'm like, oh my gosh, like, okay, ready? So I'm going to get ready for this meeting. He takes me down to Young People's down in Center City. Huge meeting. Well, it seemed huge. It seemed like 1,000 people there, right? So now I'm sitting there. I'm all over remorseful. I'm crying. I got my cardinal pet little stuffed animal because I need that for security. And all of a sudden I have this burning desire to share, right? So I keep trying to put my hand up. And he's like, down, down. I'm like, you don't understand. I have to share. So he says, all right, just put your hand up, say your name, and say you need women's numbers. I'm like, all right, I think I said something. I know I said something about women's numbers. Anything else, I don't know what I said. Because I'm like, four sheets to the wind by this time, because now I'm nervous when he picks me up, so I'm like, I gotta prepare for this event here, you know. And at the end of the meeting, it was the most terrible thing to my alcoholism ever. I'm standing there, and this gaggle of women start to converge on me. And they're not like women. They're like 19-year-old teenagers, and they all have little pieces of paper. Here's my number. They're coming up. They're hugging me. We've been waiting for you. And my alcoholism is freaking screaming, get me out of here. Like, what are you doing to me? Like, and there's Brand. My name's Brandy. Call me anytime, with the heart over the eye. And it's so freaking obnoxious. I was like, are you serious with this? Are you serious? So I'm standing there. I'm trying to be gracious because I can't be rude, right, at this point. So I'm like, all right, got out of that one. All right, so I'm ready to go home now. And he says, oh, no. We're going to Night Owl, 13th and Spruce. Super. Because now I'm coming down. Now I really need a drink, right? Now, I didn't prepare for event number two, so I didn't bring my purse. You know, I don't have the leg bag with the flask or something like that. Like, I'm totally unprepared for this. I'm ambushed. So he takes me to it's William Way Center. It's a gay and lesbian clubhouse. Frickin' terrific place. This place is so near and dear to my heart because that is where a miracle started to happen for me. You know, so I was still drunk at that point. And the take-home point for that, for some people, I guess, in here is you never know what's going to get through. You know, a little while ago, I was talking to a woman. She walked out of a meeting. She had been drinking. And she said, where else do drunks go, by the way? Oh, don't come to a meeting if you've been drinking. Oh, don't come here. You got to figure out how not to drink and then come to a meeting. Where are they supposed to go, right? So I walk out, and I'm talking to this woman, and she's listening. She's not belligerent or anything. She's listening. My friend comes up to me afterwards, and he says, why did you do that? Like, she's drunk. Why are you talking to her? I said, because somebody did it for me. So don't ever underestimate the power of your higher power getting through to somebody whose heart is open and broken and shattered. You never know. So take a chance, you know. At least you'll stay sober, right? They did, those two bozos who wrote the book, right? So, they didn't know what they were doing. I don't know what I'm doing half the time, but, you know, so, and what happened was I met the miracle started to happen that moment because I met this woman there, and she had, like, platinum blonde shaved head, right? Pink bangs that came down like this. And she had a Dalmatian, cool dog, right? So I'm like, if she can walk around looking like that, she's not going to judge me for anything I've done. I mean, I just scrape a couple cats off, drive on the train tracks like nothing. So, and she hands me this card. And meanwhile, I'm taking notes because I can't remember anybody's name. So I'm like, cool girl with the Dalmatian. I wrote down the dog's name. And she hands me a card with the I am responsible. And with the underground group, and it had a hand on it like this. And I still have that card today. And I don't know, she wrote, call me on there, and so I did. And I had to start to go to some other meetings, because people were like, just go to meetings, because meeting makers make it! Okay. So I go to meetings, I'm going to some meetings, and I was really smart, right? Because I figure I need a drink to go to these meetings, so I'll plan my drinking around my meetings. So that'll work. Or I'll just bring a drink to the meeting. And so what I started to do, I was calling this woman every night, or pretty much every night, I guess. And she would say to me, she'd always take my phone call. And she would say to me, why don't you try to call me before you drink? Why? I don't have any problems before I drink. It's just after all this stuff comes up. And then I got to tell you about the 20 years of resentment and how my hamster died when I was 12. That's the stuff that really affects me today. So the one night, I don't know, I'm in and out of a blackout, and I call her up, and it was the last gasp of my dying spirit that said to this woman on the phone, who didn't need to answer, who I didn't know from Adam, and she didn't know me. She didn't drive. But I say to this woman, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I can't do this anymore. My first honest prayer ever. And suddenly, again betraying my alcoholism, these people come to my house. And I realize that they're coming, so I'm like, shut the lights off. We're not here. So my boyfriend at the time betrays me and opens up the door. So they weave through. They find me. She picks me up and gets me ready. I take my Afghan, my teddy bear. I don't have any underwear on. And a couple of clothes that we could find. Okay. Meanwhile, other people have him out on the porch, and I didn't know this at the time. They're talking to him about my alcoholism. They're telling him that it's not his fault that I drink the way that I do, even though I told him a bazillion times that it's your fault that I drink the way that I do. And then they put me in this car, and they take me to her apartment. And they're telling me, if you need a medical detox, if you need to be detoxed, we're going to take you there. And I'm thinking in my head, oh, no, you're not. No, but I don't want to be rude. Plus, I don't know where I am. No clue, okay? And so I'm laying there on the couch. First, I had to borrow some of her roommate's underwear because I didn't have any. So that's always nice to know that you're wearing somebody stranger's underwear. So I'm laying on the couch, and I'm in and out of consciousness here. And every time I'd wake up, people were in my face. Are you awake? Can't be rude. I'm like, oh, my God. And they have this book in their hands, and they're reading stuff to me. I don't know what they're saying. I have no clue. Every time I woke up, there was somebody in front of me reading from this big book. And then when I sort of come to the next morning, I'm looking around. I'm like, oh, my God, where am I? Because I look around, and there's a huge wrought iron bird cage in the corner. Human size, okay? Gynecological table over there. Some sort of cross thing with like rings. Some kind of creepy thing in the back room, like weird whip things on the wall. I'm like, oh my God. So I learned at that moment or later on that my sponsor, a woman who became my sponsor, was a dominatrix at the time. Like, what exactly? How do you put latex on rather than take it off? I don't know what's going on there. Like, so I'm really wondering, like, what I'm doing here. And she started with me right away with the steps, right away. She didn't lecture to me. She didn't tell me what I had done wrong. She didn't tell me anything like that. She started to talk to me about her alcoholism, how she felt, how she drank, what she did, but mostly about how she felt. And she felt not exactly like me, but I could relate to a lot of it. And she started taking me through step one. And not, but like, can you admit that you're powerless over alcohol? Okay, well, you have me in a dominatrix dungeon. Yes, I think I'm powerless over alcohol. I think my life just slightly unmanageable. You know, I know what the right answer is, right? You've all met that person or been that person where, oh, I know what the right answer to say is. But she started to give me examples of how I'm powerless over alcohol, how every time I took a drink, it was going to be different this time. I'm going to drink out of a pretty glass. I'm going to take a bubble bath. I'm going to listen to Anya, some kind of something, and how it's going to be different. So that's how she, you know, and she didn't wait. She didn't wait for me to fully grasp that I'm powerless over alcohol. She was like, are you powerless over alcohol? Can you see now that you're powerless? Yes. Okay. Good. Okay. Do you believe that there's something else greater out here than you? Well, yes. I do believe that there is a God out there because he's been screwing with me my whole entire life. All right? He's not following the script. I don't know what he's doing up there, over there, or down here. I don't know. But he's messing with me, and I'm tired of it. So, yeah, I believe in him. Okay? But, of course, it comes out, yes, yes, I do. And I struggled at step two for a long time. I functioned in belief. I believed that there was this higher power out there, but I believed that there was a God out here, but I believed that he didn't believe in me anymore, and that he just gave up. But it was enough. Just like the book says, it's enough to make a start. And so if I have enough willingness to say, there's something greater than me out there, and okay, I'll believe on it. All right, so she moves me through to step three. And I wrote my own third step prayer. And this is 3 days. I stayed with her for 3 days. All right, so. And I followed her around like a puppy. And her other puppy. But she just took me through, and she didn't wait for me to grasp the whole concept. It wasn't waiting. It was okay. So I sat on her dog bed with my teddy bear and my Afghan, and I wrote my third step prayer. And then I started to pray the actual third step prayer that's in the book. Got me right into four. And I did sort of stall a little bit on four, not too much. But at the time, I got involved with this step study, big book study group. And it was very purist. It was like, you're not going to question anything in here. You're not going to ask questions. You're not going to argue with what this book has to say. You're just going to be willing and then do the next thing. And this program, for me, is not a program of suggestion at all. I'll suggest myself right into another drink. All right? I suggest you take a drink, Patty, because you had a pretty bad day. You know, And so she took me through, and I did my first four step, and then, you know, moved on, did some amends, and then my life got pretty good. So I'm going to meetings, I'm sponsoring other people, I'm doing the right thing, starting to develop a little bit more of a faith a couple years into this program, and then I meet the man of my dreams, Tim number two, people. Okay, get ready for this, all right? He's in the program. He's sober. We're doing the whole sober life thing. Patty has arrived. God is finally paying attention to what I wrote in the book. So we get married October 2010. And then a month later, I find out that he's cheating on me. A month later, at that same time, one of my most beloved patients that I worked with in home care passed away suddenly, and my life was devastated. Now my marriage is already kaput a month into it, and now the closest thing that I might ever have to a son has died. And I'm asking God at this point, do you know what you're doing up there? Because I really don't think you are. I don't think you're paying attention. Do you know what you've done? Do you know what you've done? And meanwhile, God's going, yeah, pretty much I do. Just watch. So 9 months of hell, girl after girl after girl after girl, and I'm waiting, and I'm living in this delusion that he's going to turn around and everything's going to be better, and it doesn't happen. So 9 months later, I'm ending with hanging out of a truck by my hair. That's it. And one person in this room saved me on that July 4th when I came home and realized my whole world was crashing down around me, but I didn't feel like drinking. I just felt like dying. I was like, okay, God, can you just kill me now? Like, seriously? Because I know drink's not the answer, so I'm like, please just kill me. And I sat in the back, in my back backyard, and I'm talking to Sarah on the phone. And she's just talking me through it. And And so I end up moving out. And, you know, and so my whole life for a couple months after that, quite a few months, was just filled with rage. I wanted this guy to relapse. I wanted this. I'm full of resentment. I'm full of fear. I'm going to be alone for the rest of my freaking life. And he gets to live with the girlfriend. Great. So now I'm doing good things, God, but where's my cookie? Because good gets good, right? And I have to thank, if he ever does come around, if we ever get to the point where we can talk, I will have to thank him. Not for what he did, but how he made me feel and how he made me step up for myself for the first time in my life. I was able to step up through my higher power and the people around me in this program who held me up when I could not take another step. Every night at 10 o'clock, my life would fall apart. And somebody was there. And they'd come by and they'd bring ice cream and whatever, or just sit there. And this program saved my life every day since then. You know, you always hear, like, it's a miracle you didn't drink and things like that. And that's definitely true. But the friendships that I've been able to develop in this program are things that I never thought I would ever see coming for myself. One of my best friends today is a 24-year-old tattooed from head to toe guy who is like a little brother to me. And he steps up every time. It's amazing, you know, living this way of life, because it's not just a program for me, you know. It's these steps. It's these principles. And if I have the faith now that if I keep doing the right thing and putting the next foot forward and at least being willing to do the next thing, then my higher power always will have my back, and he's never going to let me drop as long as I keep doing what I'm asked to do. Because this weekend I was like done with this whole thing. I was like, I am not going to any meetings. I'm going to go on Monday. I'm going to do the spiel. Sound good. And then I'm not going to any more meetings. Because I was done. Because I'm lonely. So that makes sense. Yeah. So, and then here I am. How my life changed around in 24 hours. And I don't see it coming. I don't see what God has planned for me. I don't see it because it always seems to be around the corner for me. But if I keep making one step at a time, one little inch at a time, eventually I'll get around that corner. And then I get to understand what he's doing in my life. You know, and today, I don't know, besides this weekend, okay, it was crappy. But my life, I've been able to do things in sobriety that I never thought that I would be able to do. One thing I've always wanted to do is horseback ride. I'm 42, and I just started horseback riding lessons in March. I'm okay with it. But it makes me happy, and it brings joy to my life. I went to a concert this summer because nobody else around me seems to like country music, so I went by myself. And I thought, I'm not going to miss this opportunity, you know. And every day for me isn't like a life beyond my wildest dreams, but I see it on the horizon, and I see it in you. And that's what gives me hope. And every day is not a struggle how not to drink. Every day is sometimes a struggle just to be the best that I can be. But I have people in my life that hold me accountable for living by these principles. And without them, I'd either be dead, suffer a spiritual death, which I don't want to experience, or drinking. You know, and it's so cliche, but one day at a time, you know, just one day, you can do this. And I don't know. It's just really, really a miracle that that someone so undeserving got this gift. You know, the mercy that my God gives me on every day, on an everyday basis, the forgiveness that he shows me every single day for my little screw-ups, for little things, If I can at least walk like that, I have a chance. At least a successful life, and I get to determine what successful means, because successful is from the inside now. It's not material things. I've been driving a car that has a headlight out for freaking 2 months because I'm too lazy to put it in. Because I'm lonely and no one will put it in. No. But, yeah. Sad, just crummy river, right? But, you know, I just want to thank everybody for an opportunity to come here tonight and to share a little bit. And maybe you can relate to it. Maybe some things you can and maybe some things you can't. But, you know, on every day, I know I can say, my name is Patty and I am an alcoholic. Thanks. Thank you.